couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's new movies I'm going to be talking about include Ralph Breaks the Internet, Creed 2, The Front Runner, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, and Mystery Science Theater 3000, The Gauntlet. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Candyman. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You're going to find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Last week, I had to give a fond farewell to Stan Lee, and of course, everything seems to happen in multiple numbers because this past week, we had another giant in the entertainment industry die, and that was William Goldman. Rest in peace. He died at age 87 on November 16th, and that was from complications in colon cancer and pneumonia. Now, he's not as recognizable as Stan Lee, but William Goldman had an indelible impact on movies throughout the last half of the 20th century. I mean, he's best known for Oscar-winning screenplays for Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and All the President's Men. And those are very strong and well-known and respectable movies, absolutely. But the thing that a lot of people remember him for, especially I remember him for, because it's all about me, of course, is The Princess Bride. I believe he wrote the book and, of course, then wrote the movie script itself. He also wrote Misery, the adaptation that Rob Reiner made of the Stephen King novel. The reason those jump out at me is, as much as Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and All the President's Men were popular mainstream movies, they were still leaning into the award bait category. Certainly, All the President's Men was the kind of movie that comes up at the end of the year. But the irreverent silliness and fun that you get in The Princess Bride, or the downright disturbing thriller element of Misery, show how he was able to work in multiple different genres, whether it be drama or comedy or action or adventure or horror, and how good of a screenwriter he was. Now, not everything he touched turned to gold. He did movies like Ghost in the Darkness, and that's okay, because everybody who's got some great movies also has some terrible movies. I mean, you can sit there and say, well, Steven Spielberg's the greatest filmmaker of all time, and you're like, yeah, have you seen Hook? Have you seen the last half of Hook? So not everything is great. But he also made a name for himself, not just as a screenwriter, but as an icon of a screenwriter. He published a book called Adventures in the Screen Trade that told these stories and kind of gave the reality behind the sausage factory that is how movies are made in a modern world. And it's one of those books that anybody who's interested in screenwriting generally reads. It's right up there with, who's that, Robert McKee, who does that screenwriting course, if he's still alive. I don't know if he's even still around anymore doing it. But William Goldman had such an impact, and he touched so many movies. He was a script doctor, and he did stuff like Twins and A Few Good Men and A Decent Proposal, Last Action Hero, Dolores Claiborne. I mean, he had a huge career from the 70s all the way through the 90s. And like I said, not everything he touched was great, but he certainly was impactful. And then he even wrote another book later on called Which Lie Did I Tell, which it documents a little bit about how he how the impact of kind of becoming a well-known screenwriter has affected him. And the reality is that most of the time people understand, they know the stars. They know the people whose faces are in the movies, and they may know the director. Not a whole lot of people know screenwriters, but William Goldman had a name that at least maybe not your average mainstream person would recognize, but movie fans will certainly hone in on. And he certainly had a way to make his voice heard. So you will be missed, William Goldman. Rest in peace. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit is Aquaman, the next in the DC Extended Cinematic Universe, which opens on December 21st.
My parents made me what I am. I am the protector of the deep.
In this trident resides the power of Atlantis. In the wrong hands, it would bring destruction. But in the hands of the true heir, it would unite above and below.
The time has come for Atlantis to rise again.
We must stop him.
The war is coming to the surface, whether you like it or not.
Now, I know this is just literally around the corner. I mean, I think it's a month from this weekend that it opens. And they've kind of held back the trailers. They did an early look at it, and you saw some of the action sequences, and you saw some of the production design. But this gives you a lot more of the story to it. And I've also seen this on the big screen. I didn't just watch this on my computer or on my television. I happened to go see a movie the other day, and this played in front of it. So it's an impressive trailer. And this is what's so dicey for DC right now. They're Superman and Batman characters, which have generally been the tent poles of the franchises, they're not doing so well. They're talking about recasting both Henry Cavill and already Ben Affleck. Is he gone? Is he not gone? I don't know. We'll see. But they're not worrying about Batman movies completely. I mean, they got a Batman standalone film, but in terms of that Justice League that they put together last year, the only thing that's really working from that one was Wonder Woman. And Wonder Woman, it was such a hit. It was almost the opposite of a movie like Justice League that was just, it was kind of fizzled at the box office. And I have a feeling Aquaman might be set up for that as well. And who would have thought, 5 years ago, if you said, oh yeah, they're going to be doing Justice League movies and the Batman and Superman stuff nobody's going to be interested in, but the Aquaman and Wonder Woman stuff people are going to love. People would have called you insane back then. But this Aquaman movie, it looks pretty good. And as long as they keep it out of cartoon elements, and that looks like it's going to be tough. But, I mean, the fact that they've got elements of the comic books and the old cartoons in there, and it's not this dark, heavy Zack Snyderverse version of the DC Universe, I think that there's a lot of potential with this movie, and I am finally getting very excited to see it. So I'm saying bring it on. The next one I want to hit really quickly is Dumbo. Opens on March 29th.
Welcome, baby Dumbo. We're all family here. No matter how small.
You have something very rare. You have wonder. You have mystique. You have magic.
Wow!
Come with me. Together, we can soar on an elephant's wings.
This is Tim Burton's reimagining of the Dumbo series, and unfortunately, since this is radio, you can't experience what the most significant elements are of this movie, which would make sense because it's a Tim Burton film, and Tim Burton's always been about the visuals. That this movie looks very interesting and looks very different than what you'd expect. It does have that sort of Tim Burton terrorscape look to it. And it does seem to be touching on other things like Big Fish and some of the other movies that he's done, in the past. But I get a taste of this, that they're moving away from the talking animals and moving towards propelling the story with the humans. And that's going to be the real challenge here, because Dumbo was, while the humans talked, you heard the clowns talking in the background, the humans were secondary characters in the original Dumbo. It was the Dumbo character and the mouse, who was the little ringmaster, and you had the other women, elephants. But Dumbo never talked. And I think that's why they're going to get away with this, because Dumbo doesn't need to talk, because he never talked in the first movie and he didn't talk in this one. It doesn't appear to, at least. And they look like they're transferring the dialogue to the characters, the human characters, it's just as long as they don't spend too much time with the human characters. Because the reality is, in a movie like this, you want to know about Dumbo. It's Dumbo's movie. It's not these little kids who are playing with Dumbo's movie. The jury's still out on this, but I might warm up to this a little more than I did the Beauty and the Beast live-action remake they did a couple years ago. And that is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Creed 2 and The Front Runner.
Stop it now. We'll be right back.
to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump right into the movie reviews with Creed 2. Adonis Creed must take the ring to defend his title of heavyweight champion of the world by fighting the son of the man who killed his father.
In the ring, you got rules. Outside, you got nothing. Life hits you with all these cheap shots. People like me, we live in the past. You got people that need you now. You got everything to lose. This guy's got nothing to lose.
I ain't got a choice.
That's the same thing your father said, and he died right here in my hands.
Okay, I'm going to be that guy. That guy who does not like the movie that everyone else seems to like. This is sort of, to me, kind of a retread of A Star Is Born. I mean, people were just gushing over A Star Is Born at the beginning of October. Oh, isn't it great? Isn't it wonderful? You can feel it. I was weeping and crying. And while I thought it was a well-made movie, I thought A Star Is Born was perfectly fine. It just didn't interest me whatsoever, and I didn't particularly like the characters. I thought Lady Gaga was good, and I liked her character, but I don't want to watch somebody in a self-destructive spiral. And apparently, I'm in the minority on that one because A Star Is Born was a big hit. Good for you, Bradley Cooper. And I feel the same way about Creed 2. Everyone seems to be gushing over this movie. Everyone is like, I saw somebody tweet, oh my God, Michael B. Jordan and Tessa Thompson are going to win Oscars one of these days. And that may be the case. They're both fine actors. I am just not a fan of the Creed storyline. And I finally realized what it was when I was thinking about this movie. And I think I talked about this when the first Creed came out. I like the Rocky movies. And the reason I like the Rocky movies, I think the strongest part of the Rocky movies, I mean, while the boxing scenes are cool and they're designed to push your buttons and they are emotional and it's hard to not get, a little bit weepy during the big ramp up to Bill Conti's theme at the end when they're fighting and getting ready to win. The key to the Rocky movies has been the characters. It's been the character of Rocky. Rocky Balboa as a character was always a sweet guy. He was a teddy bear in a tough man's body, and he really only knew how to do one thing. But when he figured out a way to do it in the right way, he became a champion and he went the distance, but it was all about getting Adrian. It was all about bettering himself through her. And while he was never the best husband or father, and he had his problems that go through all the Rocky movies, there was still a pureness there to the Rocky character. I don't get that from Adonis Creed. I don't feel that Adonis Creed is this pure, likable character. He's a punk. He's angry at the world. And even now, when he's, kind of at the height of his career, he's angry and stuck up and impulsive and everything that you don't want to see in a hero. Or you want to see, and he's supposed to change. But wasn't he supposed to change with a lot of this in the last movie? This is so just heaped on with daddy issues. Not just Rocky is estranged from his son, but and Creed is sort of his own sort of adoptive son. But you've got him trying to live up to his father. And then he's got his father was killed by Ivan Drago in the ring. And then he's going after the son of that guy. And then there's all this angst between the Dragos there. And the Dragos are just cardboard cutout characters, just like they were in Rocky IV, but that just kind of worked in sort of the way we were in a country and making movies back in 1985. This one's kind of different. And so I never got a sense that there was any sort of villain to this movie. The villain was just this very two-dimensional thing. I didn't feel like this movie follow the people I was interested in. When Rocky's on screen, I like the movie. When the fight scenes are there, yeah, because the fight scenes, they're easy to shoot to make them compelling. But it just, I just didn't like the character of Adonis. And I didn't like the character with the Tessa Thompson character, too. She feels so much like, oh, well, I'm going to be here. By the way, I have my music. Can I do my music at your show? And then there's a scene where they have a concert. I admit, sometimes I doze off in movies. I dozed off because it was this concert of her music, and it was terrible. And so I just have no interest. The poster, look at the poster for Creed 2. And it shows him kneeling on the canvas and his face in the air and he's screaming or he's crying. That's 90% of his performance in the movie. That is just constantly him emoting almost to a comical level. I mean, this at times feels like a spoof without the jokes. So, yeah, Creed 2, while everyone else seems to like it, I'm going to have to say it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk really quickly about The Front Runner. Jason Reitman directs Hugh Jackman as Cary Hart, the frontrunner in the Democratic bid for president in 1988, whose campaign collapses once his affair is discovered.
Gary Hart is the man to beat in 88.
If we hold ourselves to those highest standards, then the voters cannot do otherwise.
Senator, I want to ask you some questions about the woman at your townhouse.
Can you tell us how you know her?
You can't be serious. No one is staying in my home. There's no need for that.
I am serious, sir.
This campaign is about the future, not rumors, not sleaze, and I care about the sanctity of this process, whether you do or do not.
There's going to be a story tomorrow about me.
I actually remember when this happened, but I was like 16, so I wasn't quite paying total attention to politics. I was just starting to realize what's going on in the world. But I do remember when Gary Hart fell from grace. And it was kind of fascinating to watch because he was considered the front runner. Michael Dukakis was not anyone who was really in anybody's mind for this one. Jason Reitman directs this almost as a docudrama, and it's told as a fly on the wall in reporter meetings and in campaign meetings and everything that's going on kind of behind the scenes. And that works in that setting. What's kind of interesting for me about this is, as much as it is a political movie, it's not about the issues, is what it's not about. And yes, Gary Hart was a Democrat, and yes, they were following the Democrat primaries. He was running for office, and what they were going after really didn't have anything to do with the actual issues of the day. But it shows how easily people can get distracted and obsessed with, an affair or something scintillating or scandalous that way. And what's neat about this movie at this time is the Democrats got past their whole problem with affairs with Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton had a lot of peccadilloes, and a lot of Democrats were just okay with that. And that was wrong then. It's wrong now. Same thing happened with Donald Trump recently, becoming the president, and he's got all these other things going on. And yes, morality and how you deal with your personal life and the people closest to you, it matters. It has mattered. It always will matter. And I don't care whether you're Democrat, Bill Clinton, or a Republican, Donald Trump, if you're screwing around on your wife and you're doing it with impunity like that, I don't care if that's the way Washington works. It's wrong either way. And the people who look the other way, again, whether you're Democrat or Republican, shame on you for that nonsense. Don't go after Bill Clinton for his peccadilloes and then forgive Trump. In the same way, don't go after Trump for his and be okay with Bill Clinton and be like, oh, he was just getting a little on the side. No, it was wrong then. And it should have taken Gary Hart down, because is it about the issues? No, but how you treat your family, I think, does reflect on that. And I think that this was like the last time this really happened, that really took somebody down in this big of a thing. And it shows how it had nothing to do with the issues, but it was a fascinating way of looking at it. It's worth seeing for anybody who wants to understand modern politics and see whether this would happen in this day and age. And, you know, who knows? Maybe this level of cultural outrage is long gone. I don't know if that's a good thing or not. I mean, the movie itself is well directed and put together, and Hugh Jackman does a fine job. But I think the bigger thing is how you can look at this as saying, wow, this happened 30 years ago. What happened to us as a country that this doesn't bother us now? So in that way, I'm going to have to say the front runner kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Ralph Breaks the Internet and the Ballad of Buster Scruggs, along with Robin Hood. To Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Ralph Breaks the Internet. Wreck-It Ralph and his friend Villelope from Sugar Rush take a trip into the World Wide Web to find a way to fix their old machines.
And we are online.
We are going to the Internet!
Super excited. Just one minor thing. What is the internet? Oh, holy cow! Look at all this stuff.
Congratulations, you're a winner!
Really?
These 10 child stars went to prison. Ooh. Number 6 will amaze you.
That sounds interesting.
Ralph, come on!
I guess that's kind of a MacGuffin, the whole reason they get to the internet. It's just a reason for them to go onto the internet. What happens is the arcade that they're living in, they get Wi-Fi there, and then they go out into the internet and see what it is. And you know, that's, I mean, I guess that's the next step for the Wreck-It Ralph series. And it's a cute enough movie. I mean, look, you got John C. Reilly back, and he's got a great voice for Ralph, and you've got Sarah Silverman, who's kind of an odd choice for a Disney movie, but she has a great voice for a cartoon, and so she's, of course, playing Vanellope. And as they go out into the internet, they have to learn about themselves and chasing their own dreams and figuring out what they want to do with their digital lives. What is interesting about this movie is the original was all about the nostalgia of the 80s video games. And they didn't just go for like Pac-Man or Donkey Kong, the easy ones. They went kind of deep into the old video games. I mean, stuff like Tapper and Burger Time, stuff like Qbert that maybe people might remember who are my age, but a lot of people don't know what a lot of this stuff is. And I give them credit for the original Wreck-It Ralph. And I really liked that one because I thought that while it did put its platform on nostalgia, it really was a sweet story of character and growth and development and friendship. And this one does have that character and growth and development and friendship there. That's there. The platform is where it's not as good because it's about the internet as opposed to being about this sort of bygone days of video games. You know, maybe when the internet is not what it is today, 20 years from now or 30 years from now, this would have worked better because it's almost sort of trying to capitalize on nostalgia from a year or two ago. It'd be like making a nostalgia movie about Minecraft. That wouldn't quite work. I know they're making a Minecraft movie, but it's not for nostalgia. Overall, for a Disney movie, it has the bright colors, it has the action, it has the cute jokes, and it has the characters in it, and it has everything you want. You know, I mean, it has a good message about friendship and being yourself, but it also takes the characters to new places, and that's great. And so on the surface, it's fine as a Disney movie. It's not as good as the first Wreck-It Ralph. It does feel like it's a bit of a forced sequel, but some things just didn't sit right with me on it. It's kind of a remake of the Emoji Movie in a certain way. Is the Emoji Movie what we really need to be remaking now? I mean, the Emoji Movie got lambasted for what it was, and essentially that's what happens. The Emoji Movie is they go and they go through all the different apps and find the different things, and you have the visualized version of Snapchat or whatever. And that's what sort of the Emoji Movie hinged on, and kind of they do that with Wreck-It Ralph. And moreover, when they go to the internet, I mean, this movie becomes self-aware at a certain point. They spend a lot of time in the Disney section of their website. You know, they go there and there's like the Disney princesses, which is cute and cool. But I mean, it is sort of just stirring the pot of Disney stuff and just throwing everything Disney on the screen. I mean, they have everything, like I said, from the Disney princess to the Star Wars characters. And I love Star Wars, but I'm like, okay, quit throwing them in everything because then it doesn't become special anymore. And this is where I think the movie suffers a bit, because it is so self-aware about stuff that's currently available online as opposed to some nostalgia thing. And I'm all for nostalgia, but let's wait till it's nostalgic before we go nostalgia on it. The other thing that they do with this movie is they show the stuff that's not good in the internet in a PG way. So, I mean, like, there's a lot of stuff they don't show, but, like, they have a part where their pop-up ads are characterized in this, and clickbait videos, and stuff like equating likes with self-worth. I mean, there's kind of a message in there that's not tamped down, that's saying, oh, the more likes you get, the better you are, which is not the case. Likes on the internet do not translate to self-worth, and that's kind of a dangerous message that's getting swerved into in this movie. But I think overall, I mean, it's a kids movie and it's a family movie and it works for what it is. It's exciting. It's just not as good as the first one. But still, I'm going to have to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. The Coen brothers direct this anthology Western featuring strange and sardonic looks at the Old West.
I'm Buster. Buster Scruggs.
You're shooting ironwork.
Appears to do, yes.
Things have a way of escalating out here in the West.
My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings.
That man is a wonder. I'll just have to see him.
This actually dropped on Netflix last week, but I wanted to talk about it because it's a Coen Brothers movie, and there's nothing mundane or routine about a Coen Brothers movie. Whenever they do a movie, it should be news and it should be looked at. And I think it's fascinating that they're doing stuff for Netflix, which is important because now you're starting to see major names, people not just doing television shows, but movies for Netflix. I mean, it used to be, oh yeah, you got Adam Sandler doing Netflix movies. Who cares? He's kind of sloughing in his career. But you had Chris Pine in Outlaw King last week. I talked about that. And this one, you've got the Coen brothers, two of the most respected filmmakers on the planet, and they're doing a film for Netflix. So it's worth seeing. And I like the Coen brothers stuff, and it's funny. I showed it to my dad because he came over and I had to watch it. I said, and he was like, I like Westerns. I go, well, this isn't going to be exactly what you expect because it's the Coen brothers. If you want a Coen brothers traditional Western, go see True Grit. But this one is a little bit quirky and a little bit different. And so it's broken into these five stories, and some of them are really good. Like the Buster Scruggs one is actually really good. And like the last one's really interesting, kind of turns into a bit of a Twilight Zone movie. But there's like one I didn't particularly like, and that's the one with Zoe Kazan. That didn't jazz me, and that kind of lowered it as being a great movie to just being a good movie. But still, the rest of it, I thought, had some fascinating things. And what's interesting is I was telling my dad, I said, well, in this section, this part, this chicken that shows up in here, that's actually symbolic of something. And we start talking about it. My dad's never been somebody to look deeper into movies. He's always just gone and said, was it entertaining or not? And that was it. But I actually challenged him to say, well, this chicken represents something, and the guy that the chicken's going to be replacing represents something. And we got into the discussion of that. And then as we're driving home with my mom, he's telling her about it. And then he starts saying, well, I think in this other episode, this owl represented this. And he starts actually analyzing it, which I thought was really kind of a cool thing, because the Coen brothers are such good filmmakers that they can challenge you to look at something like that. They are almost like Stanley Kubrick. The stuff they put in there is very deliberate. Those are the kind of things that they deliberately put into movies. And it's neat to see somebody analyze that. So yeah, this is one of the better things you're going to ever see in terms of a movie directly for Netflix. It's certainly a heck of a lot better than like Bright from last year, which was, I think, the first one that really took a major bankable current star and put him onto Netflix. And so this may be where distribution is definitely going. So I'm going to have to say The Ballad of Buster Scruggs rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Really quickly, I want to talk about Robin Hood. Not much. And it's just, golly, another Robin Hood adaptation, this time starring the kid from The Kingsman.
There's been whispers of thief. He's got our commoners looking up, seeing hope.
He's under the hood.
He's obviously well-trained.
You clatter him, he's a smash-and-grabber, nothing more.
Who do you think the thief is?
He's all of us.
This movie looks terrible. It was not screened. It's got currently, last time I looked, a 14% on Rotten Tomatoes. I don't even think this movie's worth talking about that much. It looks like the Peter Hyams version of The Musketeer. It might have a lot of action. It might be interesting at certain points, but I get a real feel of that King Arthur movie from this. Remember that one that Guy Ritchie made a year or two ago? This one just does not look good. It just seems forgettable. I think it's just going to fly under the radar. Some people aren't even talking about it as a major release this week. It wasn't screened, and it gets a preemptive suck. That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be reviewing Mystery Science Theater 3000 The Gauntlet, plus the box office and the home cinema roundup featuring Candyman. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Mystery Science Theater 3000. Started in the late 80s. And it was just a small little puppet show in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And it got a spot on what it was originally, I think it was called the Comedy Channel, that then turned into Comedy Central. And Comedy Central back then, early 90s, was not what it is today. It was just making way into the market. And it was one of their pillar shows. It was one of their strong shows. Now, each episode was a two-hour block. Because if you don't know the premise of the show, it's this guy stuck up in space with these two robots, or a couple robots that he built. But two of them go into this theater, and these mad scientists send him terrible movies and then test his ability to handle them. And so he just makes fun of the movie. And so basically what you're doing is you're watching old films and they're making fun of the movie. And I just fell in love with this show when I was in college in the early 90s. My sister and I, we'd watch it. We didn't have like the channel at home, so we'd have to sneak into different dorms that would have it to try and get the lounges so we can watch the show so people weren't watching something garbage like football or whatever. And Mystery Science Theater became quickly my favorite show. And I watched it through the 90s, and they had some shifts. They had a casting shift and a couple of them, and then they had a move. They had a jump from Comedy Channel to Sci-Fi Channel. And they did a movie that kind of flopped that wasn't as good as the show. And then they disappeared right around 1999. Now, the series was brought back very famously last year with 14 new episodes. They have a new host, and they have new people doing the robots. And, I mean, Joel Hodgson's, who originally created the show, he's still involved in the new one. But they also have like new mad scientists, and they have new sets, and they put a little more production work into it because it's not just that little, you know, Saturday morning puppet show that it used to be back in the day. If you're familiar at all with Riff Trax, the Riff Trax guys got their start on Mystery Science Theater. In fact, Mike Nelson, who is the head of Riff Trax, he became the host that took over for Joel. And this is the second season of the revival. And what they did is they used to on Thanksgiving every year on Comedy Central, they do what they call Turkey Day, because all the bad movies were turkeys, you know, and they did 30 hours straight of Mystery Science Theater. And it would start like at 6 o'clock on Wednesday and go all the way through Thanksgiving. And that was like one of the greatest things for me. It was a huge deal because my sister and I, we would tape it because we caught the show later in its run. So we would tape all the old episodes and then we could watch them at our leisure. And that was one of the sad things about when it went off the air is we no longer had Turkey Day. Now, Shout Factory has brought back some of the Turkey Day stuff and they have a live stream on Shout Factory TV. But the Mystery Science Theater 3000 people, the new guys, put together The Gauntlet, which is six new episodes of the series, and for MST3K The Gauntlet, just in time for Turkey Day, the new Mystery Science Theater 3000 gang riffs on six terrible movies in a nightmare-fueled binge watch.
Ladies and gentlemen, of the world stage, prepare to witness the most mind-bending act of movie riffing ever attempted.
I present to you The Gauntlet.
The Gauntlet?
Six terrible movies riffed one after the other.
Can Jonah Heston, his robot jerks, and you at home survive six horrible movies back to back?
We can't riff six movies in a row. Our brains will melt.
Our souls will implode.
And they put it like it's binge watching, and you can watch them all in a row. You don't, it's not like a 12-hour movie or anything, but you have six different movies, and have stuff like Mac and Me, which is a famously terrible film, or Atlantic Rim, which is from The Asylum, which is a takeoff on Pacific Rim. And that's terrible. They have one called Killer Fish, which stars Lee Majors and Karen Black and Gary Collins. And it's a Brazilian production, but it's also a Fawcett Majors production, which means that Farrah Fawcett and Lee Majors were involved in the production of it. And it's terrible. It's such a ripoff, a direct ripoff of Piranha, which of course itself was a ripoff of Jaws, but it's a ripoff of Piranha, almost following similarly the same storyline. And it's terrible, but it's hilarious to watch these guys do it. And there's also Ator the Fighting Eagle, which is the final episode in The Gauntlet, and that is famously the prequel to Cave Dwellers, which is one of the most famous Mystery Science Theater movies ever done. And that one stars Miles O'Keefe as basically a Conan ripoff from the 80s. And I even remember seeing that movie in the theaters when it came out sometime in the 80s. My friend and his dad took me to go see it, and I liked it back then, but what did I know? I was like a 10-year-old kid. And there's another one they do, Lords of the Deep, which is a ripoff of The Abyss or Leviathan or all those underwater movies that came out in the late 80s. And it stars Priscilla Barnes as the most recognizable name in it. And she's, of course, from Three's Company. And it's a terrible movie. And I remember renting that when that first came out on video back in 1989. This is a great way to spend Turkey Day weekend watching these movies without having to deal with football or shopping or spending time arguing politics with your family. I'm going to have to say Mystery Science Theater 3000, The Gauntlet, totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office really quick. Last weekend, it was no surprise that Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald won with $62 million. that's nowhere near the makeup for the $200 million budget it has. But these movies, it's like the last Fantastic Beast, as a Harry Potter movie, was kind of soft in its domestic numbers, but it made a lot more money overseas. This is a movie that's a bit of a hit in America, but it's really going to generate most of its money overseas, and particularly in Europe. Instant Family did okay with $14 million, and it'll eventually, I think, break even. Widows came a little bit under that. I still don't think that they promoted that one well enough. But that's the competition. Of course, the Wreck-It Ralph and Creed 2 are going to dominate this weekend, and I think Fantastic Beasts is going to drop off, but it's still going to get some legs. But like I said, look at the overseas numbers. That's where it's going to be making its money. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This week's spotlight is on Candyman, the collector's edition from Shout Factory. One of the things Shout Factory has been doing is it's been consolidating some of these old horror movies and genre pictures, especially ones that aren't getting re-released or big special editions by the original studios. Like Candyman was originally a Universal movie, but Universal has kind of pulled back on something like this. Candyman, it was a big enough hit to make a franchise of it, but it also wasn't a big enough hit to do constant re-releases of special editions. A lot of these genre titles will go to secondary distributors, and Shout Factory's doing that. They did stuff with like Creepshow recently and Return of the Living Dead. They've done a lot of these 80s and 90s horror movies, and I've covered some of them on the show. Now, this is based on a Clive Barker story, and if you've never seen it, it's actually a pretty creepy film. The story follows a grad student searching for an urban legend of a killer.
An entire community starts attributing the daily horrors of their lives to a mythical figure.
The legend first appeared in 1890. He was attacked, mutilated, and burned to death. Poor Candyman.
A woman died in there. Leave it.
That's modern oral folklore.
I don't scare too easy. Don't know about Ruthie Jean. They ain't never gonna catch him. Who? Candyman.
The movie's pretty grisly at times. It's pretty violent because it's Clive Barker, and especially in the early 90s, it had to be bloody, and it kind of put Tony Todd on the map as a horror movie bad guy. And it deals with urban legends and the development of them, and it gets a little bit goofy and dream logic-y, but that's to be expected from a Clive Barker movie. I remember I actually saw this movie as a free preview early, before it actually came out. I saw it through a campus program that I had in college. And I thought it was fine for what it is, but it's kind of developed and had this cult following, and it's developed a lot of people who've liked it. And over the years, it's got a certain amount of quality that it's remembered for. And in fact, I think it holds up better than it did as an original movie back in the early 90s. Now, the disc comes with two versions of the movies, the theatrical cut and the director's cut. And there's no time difference between the two of them, but it's more the graphic nature of the film and elements in the movie. But what's neat about it is both of them get a 2K restoration from a 4K scan, so they can always put out a 4K release later. And they've got new audio commentaries for the theatrical cut and the original audio commentaries, but it also has a whole bunch of, in the original theatrical cut, it has a bunch of the old bonus features from when it first went on DVD, I think, in the early 2000s. And then in Disc 2, which is the unrated cut, it has a bunch of new interviews with the cast and the crew from the film as of today, looking back on it. So it's actually loaded with special features. So if you're a fan of special features, this is definitely something to get because it has both discs in it. It has both versions of the film and special features. You can spend hours watching extra stuff on it. So I'm going to have to say that Candyman and its collector's edition Blu-ray totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for this week. I need to go. And when I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about The Possession of Hannah Grace and maybe a couple other award films. But until then, have a fat time at the movies.